Hello and welcome. I'm Dr. Michelle Josephson. On behalf of CME Outfitters, I'd like to thank you for joining us today for Why Are We Still Talking About the Mycophenolate REMS in 2024? This CME activity is supported by an educational grant from the Mycophenolate REMS Group, a consortium of more than 20 companies who provide branded or generic forms of mycophenolate. CME Outfitters is a jointly accredited provider and develops and certifies continuing education activities for the team by the team, including our program today. Don't forget to follow us on X with username at CME Outfitters for upcoming CME, CE opportunities, healthcare news, and more. We'll also be responding to relevant posts received throughout this session. Again, I'm Michelle Josephson. I'm a transplant nephrologist at University of Chicago, professor of medicine, surgery, and director of education at our Transplant Institute. I'm very proud to be joined by a superb panel who I'll ask to introduce themselves, starting with Dr. Moritz. Dr. Moritz.
It's Michael Moritz, the principal investigator of the Transplant Pregnancy Registry International, headquartered at Gift of Life Institute in Philadelphia. I'm also the medical director for the Gift of Life Donor Program, the organ procurement organization for our region, which is also headquartered in Philly. And I'm recently retired after 37 years as an active liver, kidney, and pancreas transplant surgeon. I am not taking call anymore.
Hi, and I'm Lisa Cassia. I'm the Senior Nurse Research Coordinator for the Transplant Pregnancy Registry International, and I've been in the transplant field for over 30 years.
Thank you both. Now to get started, I'm going to provide a brief introduction and history of the Mycophenolate Risk Evaluation and Mitigation Strategy, or MREMS. Mycophenolate was approved in the last millennium, and evidence of teratogenicity emerged in the early 2000s. Case series showed characteristic recurrent patterns of malformations, and this resulted in boxed warning in 2007 and the requirements for a medication guide in 2008. Evidence of mycophenolate teratogenicity was paralleled by a greater regulatory effort to improve drug safety, represented by the FDA Amendment Act. This introduced the concept of REMS programs as a way to ensure benefits outweigh risks. This led to the mycophenolate REMS in 2012. Of note, since its inception, the MREMS has been a shared system, or SSMREMS, used by all manufacturers and marketers of mycophenolate products. In 2023, a parallel system, or PSMREMS, was introduced as part of the FDA's waiver process to protect patents. It is largely identical to the information in the SSMREMS. Either system can be used by clinicians and patients. Many references on today's slides will include the websites for both the SS mycophenolate REMS and the PS mycophenolate REMS. So the goals of the mycophenolate REMS is to educate providers as well as educate patients. For providers, it's to educate about increased risk of first trimester pregnancy loss and congenital malformations with exposure to mycophenolate, counseling patients of reproductive potential on preventing pregnancies when taking mycophenolate, reporting pregnancies to the Mycophenolate Pregnancy Registry, and reporting pregnancies to the Transplant Pregnancy Registry International, formerly the National Transplantation Pregnancy Registry, or NTPR. And we are joined here today by Lisa and Michael, both of whom work closely with TPRI. And also educates patients on increased risks of miscarriage and birth defects, importance of pregnancy prevention and planning when taking mycophenolate, participating in the Mycophenolate Pregnancy Registry, and participating in the TPRI. So you may be wondering, why are we still talking about MREMS? Well, there's several reasons. One is that MRENS has been suboptimal at best in preventing prenatal exposure, and we'll talk about that a little bit more. Also, new and evolving abortion laws leave limited options when accidental prenatal exposure occurs. For example, there might be absolute or six-week abortion ban restrictions, opportunities, and this restricts opportunity to consider a pregnancy termination. The potential for malformation is generally not recognized as an exception to strict abortion laws, and that's why this is so very important and relevant. So now I'm going to turn things over to Dr. Moritz, who will talk about mycophenolate in clinical perspective. This section will address the first of three learning objectives, namely to evaluate embryo-fetal toxicity and pregnancy risks associated with the use of mycophenolate. So let me turn it over now to Dr. Moritz.
Thank you, Dr. Josephson. Let's start with sort of a pre-question. What percentage of infants born to an individual exposed to mycophenolate during the first trimester of pregnancy will be born with congenital abnormalities? Is it 10 to 15%, in the range of 20 to 25%, in the range of 45 to 50%, more than 50%, or I'm not sure? And the correct answer is 20 to 25% of infants with a first trimester mycophenolate exposure will have major malformations. And at least a quarter of you got that correct. Now let's move on to some brief history about mycophenolate. Mycophenolate was the first antibiotic purified from any source discovered by an Italian named Dr. Gozio. And it's an acidic phenol from a fungus. And you should all remember that fungal products like this include cyclosporin, tacrolimus, penicillin. So fungi produce a variety of chemicals with funky properties. It's been rediscovered as an antibiotic, antifungal, antiviral, antitumor. It was attempted to be used for a lot of things until the 1960s when its immunosuppressive properties were first identified. There are two forms of mycophenolate available: MMF, mycophenolate mofetil, and MPA, mycophenolic acid, enteric coated. MMF is available both orally and intravenously, and the FDA label indications include prevention of organ rejection and allogeneic kidney, liver, and heart transplants in combination with other immunosuppressants. The enteric-coated or delayed-release mycophenolic acid, oral tablets only, as an immunosuppressant, it's now being used in other off-label indications. You'll notice that neither lung nor kidney pancreas nor small bowel nor VCA transplants are part of the label. Likewise, bone marrow transplant is not a label indication. And a variety of autoimmune conditions, including rheumatoid arthritis, inflammatory bowel disease, skin disorders, including psoriasis, and other classic autoimmune phenomena like lupus and various vasculitides, also have had some success when treated with mycophenolate. So how is it an immunosuppressant? So this pathway that's shown vertically is the de novo purine synthesis pathway. And purines is what DNA is made of. And so the ability to inhibit this pathway will inhibit DNA synthesis and thereby inhibit cellular proliferation. So this de novo purine synthetic pathway is, relatively speaking, something that lymphocytes are more dependent on than other cell types. Hence, the effect is felt most strongly by lymphocytes, and its side effects are attributable to similar but not as potent effects on other non-lymphocyte cells. The teratogenicity means the ability to cause birth defects, of mycophenolate was first described in 2001 in a child born with hypoplastic nails and shortened fingers to a mom who'd been exposed to mycophenolate during the pregnancy. Other subsequent single reports followed. And a pattern was noted. And that's what's called an embryopathy. Not random birth defects, but a pattern of birth defects that's associated with fetal exposure to mycophenolate. The most prevalent of the malformations are ear malformations, including microtia, small ears, anosia, absence of the external ear, and they may be associated with inner ear problems as well, including atresia of the auditory canal or and deafness. Also, orofacial malformations, including cleft lip and palate, congenital heart defects, tracheoesophageal malformations, and dysmorphia of the face and distal limb anomalies, like that first case where the fingers were affected. So the risk is embryo-fetal, because there are actually two things. One is the risk of birth defects, and the other is fetotoxicity, or spontaneous miscarriages. Now, spontaneous miscarriages either can be because a drug is toxic to the fetus, or they can be miscarriages due to severe malformations that are not compatible with life, and typically don't know. In 2006, we reported, when it was still called the National Transplant Pregnancy Registry, on 24 female patients, 33 mycophenolate-exposed pregnancies, almost half, 45%, had spontaneous miscarriages. And in the 18 live-born children, 4, which is 22%, had structural malformations. Post-marketing data from Roche, which was the manufacturer of CellCept, and this was only available as a branded medication at that time, they had accumulated 77 exposures, of which 33% had spontaneous abortions and 18% had major malformations. This led to the 2007 boxed warning on the product insert, which I am not going to read, except for the blue part. Use during pregnancies associated with increased risks of first trimester pregnancy loss and congenital malformations. We also, at the NTPR, in our annual report, noted that pregnancies conceived on mycophenolate, and we compared them to women who had conceived when mycophenolate had been discontinued at least 6 weeks prior to conception. Those women had a miscarriage rate of 22%. In contrast, the women who were still taking mycophenolate while pregnant had a miscarriage rate of 48%. Pre-pregnancy counseling and adequate contraception are critical if young women who need to take mycophenolate. Are there safer alternatives to mycophenolate in the setting of organ transplantation in particular, where women and all patients are typically on combination therapy of multiple drugs? In an optimal setting, a woman plans a pregnancy and her care providers have the opportunity to consider, is it reasonable for her to switch from mycophenolate to an alternative? That gives the opportunity to switch and ensure that nothing adverse happens to the allograft prior to the pregnancy. Classically, azathioprine has been the drug that most women have been switched to. Azathioprine dates back to the early 1960s, and so the experience prior to calcineurin inhibitors was actually relatively extensive, although the drug was used at much higher doses when there were no calcineurin inhibitors. Regardless, it has some capability of causing teratogenicity in animals, but not in humans. It's not been noted as a human teratogen. The retrospective cohort study, which compared pregnancies exposed to mycophenolate to those in azathioprine during the first trimester, again, almost 50% pregnancy loss with mycophenolate exposure and 24% with azathioprine. The other alternatives would include the mTOR inhibitors, classically sirolimus. They likewise do have teratogenicity in animal models. Safety data to fetal exposure to these drugs is relatively sparse. We're talking a couple dozen cases that have been reported. And the problem is that the mTOR inhibitors are inhibitors of cellular proliferation, which seems a problem when you talk about a fetus which has rapid cellular proliferation. KDIGO guidelines currently advise against mTOR use in pregnancy. And that is the current state of affairs with mycophenolate and pregnancy.
Thank you, Dr. Moritz. Now let's look at how to counsel patients of reproductive potential regarding mycophenolate use. And so we're going to go on to our learning objective number two, and that is to counsel patients of reproductive potential on pregnancy prevention and or planning during mycophenolate treatment. To open this part up, what I'd like to do is turn now to our second of three ARS questions and ask the audience, what percentage of pregnancies are unplanned? Is it A, 18%, B, 25%, C, 40%, D, 54%, or E, you're really not sure? Okay, well, let's see how everyone did. So the correct answer is C, 40%, and a third of our audience did get that correct. And so we're going to, we'll come back to this question again, but it's just important to know that it is really that high. So with that said, we're going to now move on to prenatal exposure to teratogenic drugs. So turns out that this prenatal exposure is actually quite common. And in a paper that was done by Sarayani, prenatal exposure to teratogenic medications in the U.S. occurs way too often. And although EFTA has resulted in increased regulatory efforts, turns out that only 10 of more than 140 medications with known teratogenicity risk currently have a REMS. And for the remainder, we have to rely on the warnings in the package inserts. Now, Sarayano did some other very interesting studies, which we're going to turn to now. And it turns out that the delayed introduction of the mycophenolate REMS several years after the risk of teratogenicity was well established provided us with an opportunity to evaluate the effectiveness of the REMS. And so that is really what enabled Sarayani to do the study. What Sarayani did was compare the risk of prenatal exposure among persons of childbearing potential who used mycophenolate during the medication guide period versus the period after 2012 when REMS was introduced. So let's go ahead and look at it here. And what you can see, the introduction of the medication guide that starts in the blue period and then the REMS period as depicted in the red in the slide. And in order to get at this information, Sarayani used a market scan database that had information between 2008 and 2015. And this was a national sample of privately insured patients. And the eligibility for those included were persons of reproductive potential between age 15 and 44, and these individuals had filled at least one prescription for oral MPA. And what they did is they looked at the MPA treatment period, and they looked at an index date of the dispensing day of the first MPA prescription each episode, and they looked back over 6 months. So they had two different analyses. And in the first analysis, what they did is they looked at whether there was a pregnancy that was ongoing at the time that treatment was initiated. And again, they looked at this in the two periods, the blue as indicated by the medication guide, the red as indicated by REMS. And they said, were individuals who were pregnant given a prescription for MPA? And then in analysis number two, what they did was they looked at whether or not either the medication guide as depicted in blue or the REMS period as depicted in red was better at preventing pregnancy or conception during treatment. So let's take a look at what they found on the next slide. And so what you can see here is that for analysis number one, when they looked to see what was the proportion of pregnant individuals who had mycophenolate treatment initiated, they found that actually it really came down during the REMS period. So the REMS period seemed to affect be much better at preventing providers or those writing prescriptions from writing prescriptions for pregnant women. On the other hand, when they looked at the rate of conception during mycophenolate treatment, there was really not much difference between the medication guide period and the REMS period. Now, you may be saying, well, why did this happen? Unfortunately, we really don't have specific information about why this happened for the mycophenolate REMS, but we do have, there are other REMS, and we have data from the time period for which results of the isotretinoin pregnancy registry, and you can see that in the slide. And what you'll notice is that there are several reasons why, at least for this drug, there were pregnancies that occurred. One of the big reasons was there's contraception failure. Another was that people didn't use two birth control methods. And another was unsuccessful abstinence. So then the big question is, what can we do? So let's move on to that. Think about that. So remember, 40% of pregnancies are unplanned. And there's also other things to be aware of. Implementing MREMS in clinical practice can be very difficult. For any clinician in the audience, you understand the time constraints that we're under. There's also the issue of patient perceptions. There's a level of comfort that that providers and may feel about these kind of discussions. And we're going to talk a little bit more about that. And then it's also important to consider that there may be issues that need to be addressed with respect to cultural language and health literacy barriers or specificities that need to be considered. And so one needs to sort of come up with strategies to really reduce these kind of poor outcomes and to think about how we can counsel patients so they do use adequate contraception, to think about performing pregnancy screening, to think about reporting pregnancies to the mycophenolate pregnancy registry. We'll talk more about that as well. To consider cultural and language and health literacy barriers and also other social determinants of health when counseling patients. So let's now turn our attention to the issue of counseling and recognize that we really need to prepare for this conversation, that we need to think about addressing reproductive goals prior to the start of mycophenolate, that we need to think about creating an open, supportive, and non-judgmental environment. That we need to think about increasing your knowledge and self-efficacy in providing contraceptive counseling. And we need to consider incorporating MREMS into documentation and the clinic workflow. Now, before we had this presentation, actually, Lisa, Michael, and I had an opportunity to talk a little bit about this issue of counseling. And Michael talked a bit about how difficult it is in all settings, but how particularly difficult it is to talk to adolescents about this issue, particularly when they have a very involved parent. So I'm going to, for a few moments, turn the floor over to Michael for him to share his experience in this arena. So, Michael, if you could share a couple of thoughts on this with the audience, that would be great.
I had the privilege of being a transplant surgeon, and in that role was often the most trusted provider that the patient would see. COVID sort of re-emphasized that patients would say that was the only environment in the healthcare world where the office where they would feel safe, where they knew everyone had been vaccinated and everyone stuck to the masking guidelines. And they've always taken the transplant office as some place of trust because No one prescribes medications they shouldn't get there, et cetera. When you're talking with younger people, particularly young women, about this whole pregnancy thing and mycophenolate, so you sort of have to have a minimum of yeast. You have to have a conversation with the patient, period. You have to have a conversation with the patient alone. So those with clingy parents, you get an excuse, you get someone to call them out into the waiting room. You must have a conversation with whoever they bring to the office, then have a conversation alone. If they happen to have a significant other, that's great too. But you have to start at some point with a conversation with the young woman alone. She may not be honest with other people in her life about her plans for pregnancy. In fact, there's no reason to think she would be honest with parents or even with a significant other. But she will be honest with a trusted provider. That's the best we can do.
Thank you. I think those are really important points. So let's then think about some of the issue about contraceptive counseling. So what do we counsel? Well, we want to counsel patients of reproductive potential, and that would include anyone from puberty all the way through menopause. And I sometimes think people miss that group. I mean, the menopausal group to counsel on, sort of maybe not realizing that they are potentially at reproductive age. We want to exclude anyone who's had a hysterectomy, oophorectomy, or premature menopause. And I meant to say really premenopause when we want to talk within that reproductive period. How often should we counsel? Well, we should certainly start prior to initiation of mycophenolate, and then it's important to bring it up at every follow-up visit. That will also make it much more easy to discuss and also emphasize the importance. When to use contraception, certainly during treatment, as well as at least 6 weeks after ending medication. And what about pregnancy screening? How often should we do it? Well, we should start immediately prior to the start of treatment, 8 to 10 days after starting treatment, and then at every follow-up visit, as well as 6 weeks after discontinuation. So what about birth control? What are our options? Well, it turns out that we do have several options. Now, if someone simply wants to have one method, then aside from sterilization with either tubal ligation or vasectomy, the only possible option is really an IUD. But if someone doesn't want either sterilization or an IUD, then you have to use two methods. And you can use sort of a menu of potential methods, as you can see here, and you can use a method from what's listed in the list of B, or you can use B in either C1 or C2. So you can sort of put all of, you know, mix and match a little bit if you are going to do two methods, but you do need to use two methods. Now, the other way that you can help a patient prevent pregnancy is to inform them and provide them with emergency contraception. So let's take a look at those options. And you can see that there are several options. There's Plan B, and there's also Ella, and there's a copper IUD. But they do need to be instituted within days, 3 to 5 days. If you're doing Plan B, it has to be 3 days. The other methods you can do within 5 days. And the good news is that at least Plan B is over the counter, but they do need Ella does need a prescription, and certainly a copper IUD, you're going to need to have someone to insert it. So, those are very important good options. Now, we spoke a little bit earlier about the fact that you may not feel comfortable talking about these issues or either contraception or how to approach it. And it turns out you would not be alone. So there's a study that comes out of Canada done by Michelle Helenovich and colleagues, where they did a survey of nephrologists in Canada as well as the U.S. Canada is in red, U.S. in blue, and they looked at a number of areas. But one thing they talked about and asked is asked what was the average frequency of counseling over a month. And what they found was that there was a good number of people who had not counseled any women, who don't counsel any women per month, and or less than one per month. So you can see it can often be very infrequent. And when they moved on to ask about the sense of confidence in counseling or talking about other issues within women's health, what you can see is that the minority did not have either great confidence or either felt very confident or confident at all. And so you may say, well, I don't feel that way. I don't feel particularly confident. And certainly getting to know these issues would be one way of getting that issue and becoming more confident. But another approach would be to consider partnering with an OBGYN health provider. And in doing so, they can help in terms of help with the counseling. They can also help prescribe. And most importantly, if the patient is going to get an IUD, they can help with fitting and insertion of the IUD. So that's a very good relationship to build and to develop a strong partnership with an OBGYN or a women's health provider. So with that, we are next going to hear from Lisa Kinsella about the mycophenolate registry. So this is going to address our third learning objective, monitor relevant pregnancies and encourage patient reporting to the mycophenolate pregnancy registry. So Lisa, I'm going to hand it over to you.
Thanks so much, Dr. Josephson. And actually, we're going to start with our next final audience response question. So if pregnancy does occur while using mycophenolate or within 6 weeks of stopping it, what is the first step for patients to participate in the registry? Stop mycophenolate immediately, inform their healthcare provider, notify the registry by phone or secure email of pregnancy, or D, to request an informed consent from the registry, or E, you're unsure. Go ahead and register your answer now. So the correct answer, which almost half of you did respond, is inform the healthcare provider. So that's really important to start the conversation off. So really, why are we doing these registries still? And what really the purpose is to mitigate or eliminate mycophenolate pregnancy exposure. And by registering, we can help to expand the education for both patients and healthcare professionals. And really, I think it starts with what Michelle spoke about the most is counseling these high-risk patients regarding the proper contraception while they're on mycophenolate. So what are the steps for the pregnancy registry? So there's six steps, and it's really important to, you know, remember what to do. So what we're going to do is if the patient does get pregnant while taking mycophenolate or within 6 weeks of stopping it, we want them to inform their healthcare provider immediately. And once the pregnancy is confirmed, with permission of the patient, the healthcare provider can report the pregnancy to the registry. And the registry will contact the patient after speaking with the healthcare provider. And there is an informed consent, which explains what to expect from the registry, including the patient's rights will be sent to the patient. So really just an overall informed consent. And then what we also will do is the healthcare provider should offer to review the document with the patient to answer any questions. And then upon patient consent, the patient and healthcare provider will provide their contact information and some information about the patient's health and the baby's health to the registry. So what type of information are we going to provide? So it's going to be the patient's participation in the registry does not require any additional healthcare testing, visits, or treatment beyond their regular medical care. I think that's really important for patients to know about registries in general. It's usually just telephone interviews because they just want to know the outcomes. So they're going to contact the patient at 3 months of pregnancy and two more times over the next 6 months and at the mother's approximate due date and when the baby is 2, 6, 12 months old. And it's really just important to make sure that you keep your contact information up to date or if the patient might change their contact information. And of course, any information provided by the patient will be kept private and the patient can withdraw consent at any time for any reason. Once again, when calling the mycophenolate pregnancy registry, they're going to ask for the healthcare provider's contact information, the patient's contact information, and some pregnancy information. And then those consents will be, provided to the patient and, returned so there can be continued contact with the mycophenolate pregnancy registry. What is the role of the healthcare provider? So the healthcare provider is going to be asked to complete either a paper-based case report form and submit that via mail or fax, and then or they can enter data directly into the electronic data capture system. So that would be, something that the healthcare provider is. And then once again, just a reminder of really making sure that you have up-to-date contact information throughout the participation. So some data elements that are collected include the mycophenolate exposure, including the dose and the timing of the exposure, maternal and fetal outcomes, and a root cause analysis just to assess what circumstances led to the fetal exposure, and then the frequency of education and counseling. And I think it's just really important that healthcare providers are aware that we know unplanned pregnancies can happen, so that contraception counseling is really the key in this whole process to prevent mycophenolate exposures. In this slide, there's just the contact information for all the registries. And I think, it's really important that transplant patients report to the transplant pregnancy registry as well, just because they might not be on mycophenolate, even though they might have been on in the past. And also, just remembering that the more outcomes that we have, the better information we can provide to patients and their healthcare providers. So overall, I think it's just really important to remember the contact information for the mycophenolate pregnancy registry and to call them if there's an exposure, and knowing that it's really minimal information that is provided in minimal timing. So it's not going to, be a burden on the patient or the healthcare provider.
Thank you, Lisa. Now to summarize our program today, I'd like to offer four SMART goals. SMART stands for specific, measurable, attainable, relevant, and timely. So we're going to educate and remind persons of reproductive potential about risk. We're going to engage in pregnancy prevention and planning, including a discussion of acceptable methods of contraception during mycophenolate treatment, consideration of alternative immunosuppressants with less potential for embryo-fetal toxicity if pregnancy is desired. We're going to report to the mycophenolate pregnancy registry any pregnancies that occur and encourage pregnant patients to participate in the registry. Also, consider reporting to the TPRI for transplant recipients. Support collection of evidence to improve understanding of REMS failure and enhanced prevention of prenatal exposure to mycophenolate. We also want our audience to read and share additional education resources, such as the brochure for healthcare providers, and for our patients, the brochure for patients. And so, with all of that said, let's quickly revisit our three ARS questions and see how we do now. And then we're going to go to the Q&A session, because I see we have some really wonderful questions that are waiting for some discussion. So our first question is, what percentage of infants born to an individual exposed to mycophenolate during the first trimester of pregnancy are born with congenital abnormalities? Is it A, 10 to 15%, B, 20 to 25%, C, 45 to 50%, D, more than 50%, or E, I'm still not sure. Well, I'm really thrilled to see the improvement and to see how well the audience has done in on this question. I can see now the majority of the audience do get the correct answer at 20 to 25%. So that's fantastic. Okay, so we're going to go on to our next audience response question. With what percent of pregnancies are unplanned? Is it A, 18%, B, 25%, C, 40%, or D, 54%? And I guess E is still, I'm not sure. But hopefully you are sure now. Okay. Again, everyone's doing really, really well, and the majority got the correct answer at 40%. So this is really fabulous. And so let's go on to our last of three audience response questions. And that question is, if pregnancy occurs while using mycophenolate or within 6 weeks of stopping it, what is the first step for patients to participate in the registry? Is it A, to stop mycophenolate immediately? B, to inform the healthcare provider, notify the notify the registry by phone or secure email of pregnancy, or D, request an informed consent form from the registry. Okay, well, this one you nailed. Everyone did beautifully. So we had 90% of the audience got this right, with the answer being inform healthcare provider. So this is fabulous. And what's also fabulous is that we have left some time for questions. And so let's get started. I'm going to open it up. And I know that Lisa and Michael are looking forward to working with me to answer these questions. So let me
start. The first questions were from when I was speaking, so I can address them.
Please.
There are two questions about the mycophenolate REMS and the TPRI.
Okay.
Does the mycophenolate REMS and the TPRI share best practices or coordinate in any way? So the mycophenolate REMS collects data, and it has since 2012. It has not released or published any information. They do have brochures for providers and for patients about pregnancy prevention and the risks of mycophenolate, but we have no idea, frankly, what data they have collected. So no, we do not share best practices or coordinate with mycophenolate REMS because they don't cooperate. Is there any current outcomes data from the mycophenolate program? And the answer is no. As I said, they don't release anything to the public. Presumably, they report to the sponsors, which is fine, but that doesn't help us.
Okay.
When malformations do occur, what are the two or three most common problems? And so they're above the neck. There's the ear problem. So microtia is the classic. Along with some component of inner ear dysfunction, which can include deafness, cleft lip and palate, and the facial dysmorphism. Those are the classic, most common parts of the mycophenolate embryopathy. And then the last question that I'm going to touch on is a difficult one. How do you determine if it's safe to switch from mycophenolate to a safer immunosuppressant in terms of preventing organ rejection? That's a very difficult question. Most people leave the hospital on their meds, they never change them. So if they've been on mycophenolate for a long time, how do you know if it's okay to switch them? Well, let's think about that in a general way. So if you had someone who was 5 years out from a liver transplant that they had as an adolescent, their rejection risk, and they're a good patient and they come to the office and their drug levels are always okay, yeah, that's a person who's got a low risk of rejection. Same thing with a recipient of a living donor kidney who's had it for quite a while. And so you can make a judgment there that, it's going to be okay if we switch them to something. And what's at the other extreme? Retransplants, high PRA, someone who just had their second transplant, they're highly sensitized, it's 9 months later and they want to get pregnant. That's an example of someone who would be very high risk to switch to a less potent drug, because all of the alternatives are potentially less potent. Certainly azathioprine is less potent. That's why it's been replaced by mycophenolate. So that is a difficult question. We don't have ways to measure rejection risk in time, and we don't have ways to measure global level of immunosuppression either. There's been a variety of tests proposed and none of them work. So that's the current state of affairs for that.
So there's a question that I think dovetails well with that last comment you just made, Michael. And the question in the chat is, the question section is, do mTOR inhibitors work just as well as mycophenolate for preventing rejection? And I would say that they could. What do you think?
I think they're very potent. And you've had trials mostly in Europe where things are different. Immunogenicity in them is less, and the genetic differences amongst the population are lower. But there have been steroid plus mTOR inhibitor trials that have had pretty decent results. No one is going to do that in the States with the level of genetic diversity that we have. But no one's been able to do that with mycophenolate. So arguably mTOR inhibitors are at least as potent in an immunosuppressive way as the mycophenolate drugs. And I think if you're in that position, if you're a lung transplant physician facing, they have with a very higher risk of rejection than any other organ real problems with chronic rejection. Yeah, I'm not so sure I believe that azathioprine would be the right drug. And I might try something that I think is a little more potent.
Really good point. So there's an abundance of wonderful questions. So one question that I see here is, in your practice, who does the counseling on pregnancy prevention? A transplant coordinator, a nurse, a physician, a pharmacist, others? So I think maybe we can each speak to this, because I think probably different programs do it differently. And in my program, before the transplant, the pharmacist does talk to the patients and brings this up. But then I would say after transplantation, it's usually, now I'm talking as a transplant nephrologist, and so, I can't talk as a transplant hepatologist, but in my practice, at least, it's generally the transplant nephrologists who are then doing the pregnancy prevention counseling as well. But other people might mention as well. So let me turn the floor over to Michael and Lisa as well, and have them share their experiences in this realm.
I think that it should be everybody. I think because it's so important that patients know that there is a pregnancy risk. And I think many patients, because of end-stage organ failure, might not think they can get pregnant even. So I think it's very helpful to reiterate from everybody if they hear it. And I think post-transplant, a transplant coordinator or their post-transplant nurse would be very helpful in reiterating what was said pre-transplant too. And we know that there can be a long time between pre and post-transplant as well.
All really good points. Michael, any thoughts on this as well?
Lisa, while I may think that patients trust me, I really don't know. And neither does anybody else. So if the nurse coordinator and the pharmacist and the provider, whether that's a physician or a mid-level provider, doesn't matter. If everyone mentions it, the message is more likely someone's going to be trusted and the message is more likely to get home.
No, I think those are really good points. So here's another very practical question, which is an important question, something we did bring up, and really speaks to this issue of how important it is to repeat and to really emphasize and go over this material. And the question is, in your practice, do you counsel patients about pregnancy prevention at every visit? So I asked Michael what his thoughts are, and then I'll chime in as well.
I think I always try to. On the other hand, I'm sure that there were individuals who I thought were at higher risk of getting pregnant or who didn't have an established a relationship with OB-GYN that I belabored the point on more than others.
What, Lisa, thoughts on that?
It's one of the first things when I'm talking to patients about pregnancy that I ask them, are you on mycophenolate? Do you know that you should not get pregnant? And are you, you know, using effective birth control? So I think it's something that anytime I talk to a young woman of childbearing age that I will mention.
You know, one other point, though. So that paper that Dr. Josephson mentioned from Sariani about the MREMS program and before it existed. Well, in their data, 70% of the people taking mycophenolate are not transplant recipients.
Yeah.
The transplant recipients have the benefit of this whole, you know, cohort of caregivers. But if you're in a rheumatologist or a nephrologist's office, I think it's the nephrologists who usually are treating lupus nephritis. You don't have, they may not have as many, they don't have as many resources in terms of patient counseling. And that's a whole different audience than the transplant crew. We don't own this drug. It's used more for non-transplant indications than for transplant indications. And I think that's part of the problem, frankly, because the transplant community is smaller and easier to educate because it is smaller.
That's a really, really good point. And that sort of, in a way, dovetails nicely with this question, which is how often is MPA used as a single agent? And so it's used, I can't even think about it. In transplant, I don't think I've ever used it as a single agent. However, in other settings, it can be used as a single agent and may well be used as a single agent. And it's, you know, you also bring up the point about rheumatologists, it could also be gastroenterologists that are using the drugs. So there are really are a whole potpourri of potential areas within medicine where this drug can be used. And in some of those, it may be used as a single agent. And that does bring up a number of issues and concerns. I don't know, Michael or Lisa, if you have some more comments or thoughts on that.
I think my one comment is that we did see these teratogens still with single use as well. We know that the other medications we use for transplant patients did not have that same signal. So it's really important to remember that as a single agent, these birth defects have been reported.
Right. No, I think that's a really crucial point there is that this is really, we do know this is related to MPA. We know this is related to MPA also because of some animal data that that are out there. And Michael, I don't know if you want to speak a little bit to the animal data that are out there as well.
Medicines are teratogenic when in animal models where you give ginormous doses. And those are very hard to translate into the human condition. Mycophenolate at weight-based kinds of equivalences, mycophenolate's teratogenic in animals at what would be roughly therapeutic doses, which is very different, say, than the animal data on tacrolimus or sirolimus, because again, at 100 times clinical dosing, a lot of funky things happen. But at standard clinical doses amongst the immunosuppressants, only mycophenolate in animal models is teratogenic. It's highly suggestive that you'd see that in humans. And it's unfortunate that it took a fair amount of time from its release in 1995 until 2006 for us to publish that.
Well, I see our time's just about up, so I'm going to close out with a couple of quick comments. That is for any colleagues or your colleagues who have missed tonight's live event. This program will be available soon and on demand. Activity at CMEOutfitters.com. And also, don't miss two upcoming video case study demonstrations on how to optimize the mycophenolate REMS in practice. And with that, I will thank everyone very, very much.